Welcome to the Chilean Sea Blob Podcast. In each episode, I'll share a previously published short fiction written by me, Theodore Carter. The stories will slither in and out of genre distinctions, but will consistently stay weird. Now, let's get started with today's story. The Hoodooin' Doll. Jed took the package from the UPS man, looked at it quizzically, and studied the sloppy scrawl on the address label. "You expecting something good?" the delivery man asked. "Not expecting anything," Jed said, his eyes still focused on the box. The delivery man shoved the electronic signature pad under Jed's nose. "Sign here, please." Jed pinned the package to his side with his elbow, accepted the electronic clipboard, and hurriedly signed his name. "You seem pretty excited," the UPS man said. While handing back the clipboard, Jed looked at the man's face for the first time and noticed a toothy grin underneath his brown mustache. The UPS man was teasing him, it occurred to Jed, and he wondered why he so often found himself the subject of ridicule. Jed shrugged his shoulders. "I guess so," he said. The UPS man didn't speak, but looked down at his clipboard, gave a nod of approval, then turned and walked toward the elevator. Not many people knew his address. Jed thought it likely his mother had found some childhood relics while cleaning out the attic. He felt the weight of the box to see if it could be a stack of his old rodeo magazines or perhaps his bottle cap collection, but the shape and weight didn't seem right for either. Jed considered it a small triumph when a situation dictated that he reach into his pocket and pull out his Swiss Army knife. Even now, alone in his small apartment, he felt impressive as he rolled up the sleeves of his flannel shirt and used his handy knife to cut through the packing tape. The box was chock full of newspapers, more specifically the sports section of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He didn't know anyone in New Orleans. Beneath the crumpled newspaper lay a hideous humanoid figure constructed from what looked like refuse. The figurine's head was a crude clay skull molding, complete with strands of dried out hair. The doll's mouth was filled with a row of teeth aligned behind a lipless grin. Broken sticks, old chicken wire, and long strands of bristly hair intertwined with the twisted construction of its limbs. It wore bright orange pants and a rather elegantly sewn black felt jacket, complete with colored plastic gemstones, white trim, and buttons. Jed knew the bizarre gift had to have come from Roy, his freshman roommate. There was a card, more accurately, a torn slip of diner menu, with writing atop the list of a la carte breakfast items. Roy had written, "Jed, a genuine voodoo doll from NOLA. Creepy, huh? Off to Houston next. Maybe I'll finally see a rodeo. Scooter." Scooter was a name bestowed upon Roy in college sometime after his freshman year. Jed didn't know the significance or origin of the nickname, even though Roy seemed to think he did. Hopelessly friendly and loyal, Roy didn't seem to remember that he and Jed hadn't talked much after freshman year. Their pairing had been an awkward match. It could only be explained by the humor the student housing office must have intended by coupling Jed, a cattle ranch kid from Gilroy, California, with Roy Gill, a suburbanite from the Santa Monica area. Roy had taken a job with a management consulting firm after graduation, which meant he traveled to a new city every few weeks. While Jed didn't even know Roy's phone number or mailing address, Roy would periodically send Jed postcards from various U.S. cities. A postcard had arrived a few months earlier from Miami Beach, depicting a metallic badge that read, "Official Thong Inspector." A postcard from Seattle had shown the fish market. Now, here was the voodoo doll from New Orleans. Whenever Jed received these mementos, Jed thought of new reasons why his position at the Wild Horse and Burro Division of the Bureau of Land Management, Bakersfield Field Office, was more important than management consulting. While sitting in his cubicle and calculating the amount of public land needed for a population of wild ponies, Jed considered himself a white-collar cowboy. He didn't understand management consulting, but got the sense it meant putting on a nice suit and weaseling companies out of revenue. He imagined Roy would be very good at a job like that. Jed turned the doll over in his hands, looking for some clue as to its utility. There was no hook on the back to suggest it should be hung on the wall, no attached card describing its historical significance, and no instructions for ceremonial use. But because it was a gift, Jed couldn't bring himself to throw it away, despite its hideousness. His sparse studio apartment left only a few options for display. Aside from his futon bed, the center of his decorating scheme, Jed's only other furniture was a bureau and a small table on which he'd placed an old TV. He put the doll on his dresser, propping it against the wall in a standing position next to his wallet, keys, and boombox. The doll's orange pants and gemstone jacket buttons looked especially garish. It was the only ornamental item in the room aside from the BLM lands map tacked over the bed. Despite its 12-inch stature, the colorful figurine was now the focal point of his colorless apartment, its expression suggesting a gregarious and mischievous personality. Jed felt a bit embarrassed as he undressed in front of the doll while preparing for bed. There was something unnerving about its representation of animate life. He took one last look into the carved sunken eyes and wide grin of the misshapen clay head before turning off his bedside lamp. Why had Scooter thought he'd be interested in such a grotesque piece of folk art? As morning sunlight filtered through the Venetian blinds, Jed woke to find his voodoo doll pacing atop his dresser, one hand or stump held close to its head as if holding a phone, the other gesticulating in grandiose motions. Jed knew from his own experience and from stories told by others that upon waking, it is not uncommon to confuse a dream with reality. This knowledge was not at all comforting as he watched the doll's gestures become more emphatic. The figurine was obviously irate over something, and Jed flinched as it suddenly slammed the invisible phone into its non-existent receiver. Afraid to move, Jed sat in bed and watched the doll walk over and sit on his cowhide wallet, reach into its coat pocket, tilt its head to the side, put both arms up toward its mouth, and tilt its head back in a mock exhalation. The figure stared off into the corner of the room opposite Jed and took periodic puffs off an imaginary cigarette. Jed wiped the morning grogginess from his eyes but still saw the doll moving its left arm up to its mouth. He tried to figure out what had happened to create such delusions. Had he added spoiled milk to last night's mac and cheese? Had some hallucinogen been mixed into his toothpaste? Had Scooter's package contained mind-altering pixie dust he'd inhaled while rummaging through the crumpled newspaper? As the doll stubbed out the cigarette, Jed grew hopeful that some sort of mechanical device lay inside its twig construction. He grabbed the doll off the shelf, its body turning rigid in his hand. He pulled it close for a more thorough examination, but found nothing that would suggest the joints or motors necessary for movement. Jed even sheepishly lifted the doll's jacket and pulled down its pants in hopes of finding answers. Discovering nothing, Jed put the figurine back on his dresser. Now finished with its cigarette, the doll began miming a new action. It removed its jacket and pants to reveal its svelte twig body. It tilted its head back, ran blunt arm ends through stringy dried hair, and then rubbed its armpits. And because there was nothing else he could do, Jed decided he would step into the shower and get ready for work. He hoped to regain whatever mental capacity he'd lost during the night by following his predictable morning routine. Aside from the moving doll, everything was as it had been the day before. Physically, he felt fine. Dressed and ready for work, Jed took a few minutes to watch the doll. It was completely still, balanced on his bureau. As he sat on his bed, staring, Jed felt as ridiculous as when he'd thought the doll had come alive. "Is that it, doll?" he said. "No more action?" Motionless, the doll peered back with vacant eyes and its toothy grin. Unwilling to give credence to what he'd seen earlier, Jed left his apartment, got into his pickup, and drove to the office. Each day, as Jed sat in front of his government-issued computer, he reminded himself that the federal taxpayer paid his salary. It was only fair that he conduct his analysis of wild horse and burro grazing lands with maximum efficiency. This meant the internet was strictly a workplace tool to aid in his implementation of the Wild Horse Act of 1959. Numerous departmental memos had said as much. Still, after watching his voodoo doll hold a phone conversation, smoke a cigarette, and take a shower, Jed couldn't resist spending the entire day attempting to learn everything he could about New Orleans voodoo. Though he tried to convince himself he hadn't seen anything, he rationalized his research as cautionary background information, just in case. He'd exhausted the most credible sites by mid-morning, web pages of voodoo shop owners, voodoo priests, and historical accounts. Even the pages written by the most devout believers said nothing about voodoo dolls coming to life. Desperate for some viable explanation for what he may have seen, Jed ventured onto fringe websites that seemed less about voodoo than about all things bizarre and grotesque, including one site featuring photos of roadkill. He pulled his rolling chair as close to his computer as his fiberboard desk would allow and leaned in toward the screen in an unsuccessful attempt to hide his web wanderings from coworkers. Jed was startled by the sound of Randy's voice over his shoulder. "Whoa, cowboy, what you looking at there?" Randy had given Jed the name Cowboy Jed's second week on the job after he'd worn a larger-than-average belt buckle to secure his casual Friday jeans. Jed swiveled in his chair and saw Randy leaning against the file cabinet, his trademark American flag coffee cup in hand. Randy's voice always made Jed wish he were somewhere else, and this day his coworker's presence was especially troubling. Randy had already noticed Jed's non-work-related internet use. Jed envisioned his name in the 2004 Inspector General's report on government waste, fraud, and abuse. Randy placed his coffee mug on the cabinet, put his left hand on Jed's desk, and leaned in for a look at the screen. Jed could smell his coffee breath. Randy wrinkled his sun-stiffened brow as he read the page entitled Satan at Work and gazed at the pictures of unidentified mammals flattened on various suburban streets. As if it were a gesture he'd rehearsed, Randy straightened his lanky frame, put his hand on his hips, shook his head, and said, "Well, cowboy, I always knew a quiet guy like you had to have something going on outside the office. Didn't know it was this." "I clicked the wrong link, that's all." Jed had gone with Randy for beers after work once. The outing had ended with Jed sneaking out early, while Randy stayed behind to drink his fifth Bud Light and sing along to the jukebox. "Whatever floats your boat, cowboy," Randy said. "Randy, I'm serious. I just misclicked, I swear," Jed said. His right hand squeezed out an oversized paperclip symmetry. "Hey, I'm not the boss man, cowboy. But if I was, I might switch you to decaf." Randy was always talking about switching people to decaf. He gave Jed a military salute and walked out of his cube. Watching Randy leave, Jed thought how all of this could have been avoided if Scooter had just kept the doll for himself. The vividness of what he'd witnessed that morning was beginning to fade as Jed drove home. He told himself that whatever had happened, or whatever he thought had happened, would never happen again. There would never be a reason to contact any of the 8 carefully researched voodoo experts he'd notated on a yellow legal pad lying on the passenger seat. Still, as he turned the key and opened his apartment door, he prayed silently that he'd find the voodoo doll motionless on his dresser. He also harbored the fear that he'd find the ugly doll had gone berserk in his absence and ransacked the place, that it had carved pentagrams into the walls and learned to speak in tongues. He swung the door open. Standing on top of his dresser, the doll moved its arms as if stacking things on high shelves. These mundane actions were somehow far more frightening than the aggressive behaviors Jed had feared. The easy movements suggested longevity and permanence. A short burst of illogical animation would surely end quickly, but the figurine could go on like this for days, maybe even months or years. The familiarity was eerie. Jed snatched the doll. Again, it grew rigid in his grasp. He thought about throwing it against the wall, but was conscious that such a violent reaction would only confirm a slipping mental state. He placed the doll back on the dresser, where it continued to organize its invisible items, placing some things down low and other things so high it had to extend to its full 12-inch height When finished, the doll breathed deeply, its chest inflating and deflating in what would have sounded like a deep exhalation or sigh. It removed its felt jacket, walked over to the boombox, and hung the garment on the volume knob. Jed gently placed his wallet and keys in their usual spot and took a seat at the foot of his bed. The doll sat on Jed's wallet. It extended its right arm for a moment and then leaned back as if supported by a large cushion. It appeared to be watching something, maybe an invisible TV. The doll's relaxed state put Jed, to some degree, at ease. As the clay head peered into space, Jed took the opportunity to set up his laptop and compose an email to his 8 well-researched voodoo experts. The body of the message was the same for each recipient. I'm writing because I know you to be an expert on voodoo mythology and the voodoo religion. I'd like to know if you've ever heard stories of voodoo dolls moving on their own. Are there any rituals aimed at making dolls come to life? I would greatly appreciate any answer you can give me. Sincerely, Jed Kendall. Jed chose his words carefully, not wishing to suggest that he actually believed his voodoo doll could move, yet still hoping to invite a retelling of any folklore or anecdote that could shed light on what was happening in his apartment. This proactive approach left Jed with a sense of accomplishment. He looked at his dresser where the voodoo doll was engaged in some complicated abdominal exercise. The doll lay on its back with its legs bent at a 45-degree angle. It reached left arm end to right leg and right arm end to left leg in a quick tempo, and Jed wondered why his lunacy was so unlike romantic fictional accounts, which so often included more impressive delusions. Why did his descent into madness involve a mini figurine intent on keeping a shapely figure? Following the plan of action he'd set for himself at work, Jed next dug out his old dorm directory and dialed the number for Roy's family in Santa Monica. Mr. Gill didn't seem to remember Jed, or even pretend to. Still, he gave Jed Roy's cell number. Jed tried to rehearse lines in his head before he called. Roy, so what's the story with this voodoo doll? Or, Roy, how is New Orleans? But thinking about the conversation only made Jed more anxious. He wasn't good on the phone. It was usually best just to dial without thinking too much. Hello? Hello, Roy, it's Jed Kendall. Jed could hear the background murmur of a multitude of voices. It sounded like Roy was at a bar or a party. No fucking shit. Jed Kendall, how are you? Roy's enthusiasm left Jed unsure whether or not he was being made fun of. Self-conscious, Jed became more direct. Roy, what was that thing you sent me? Where did you get it? You like it, huh? Scooter's got all sorts of tricks up his sleeve. Maybe Roy was drunk. Freshman year, Roy had been drunk quite a few times. But I mean, where did you get it, Roy? This friend of mine has a buddy in New Orleans, and this guy's cousin is a full-on voodoo priest or some shit. But how are you, man? How's life? Look, I need to know where you got the doll. Jesus, Jed, a little tightly wound, aren't you? Roy paused. Jed realized now that he'd made it clear he hadn't just called to chat. Roy started up again in a softer tone. Yeah, well, this voodoo priest told me to forget all those phony shops in the French Quarter and that I should go to the park bench by the river where you can get the authentic stuff from a Creole bum who sells these dolls like a New York street vendor sells Rolexes. This is the real deal, Jed. No fucking around. So do they put spells on it or something? The hell if I know. I just picked the creepiest looking one. Jed, man, how you doing? It sounds like you could stand to loosen up a bit. I'm coming to San Francisco in a couple months. You should drive up. Jed looked over at his dresser. The figure was now standing with its hands on its hips, twisting its torso, working its obliques. I don't know. I'm pretty busy with work. Jed tried to picture himself flying to New Orleans and walking the banks of the Mississippi looking for a bum hawking voodoo dolls. It didn't seem productive. Yeah, I understand. Jed realized he wasn't getting anywhere. Look, Roy, I've got to get going. That's all you called about, Jed? About the doll? This was his last chance to come clean to Roy about what had happened, if anything had in fact happened. I just wanted to know where you got it. Yeah, I thought you'd like that. Hey, thanks for calling, Jed. I'll send you a postcard when I get to San Francisco. Okay, thanks, Roy. There was nothing left for Jed to do but sit the rest of the night and wait for the doll to stop moving. He certainly couldn't turn his back on the thing, and while he thought about leaving the apartment, he couldn't stand the thought of missing the exact moment the doll stopped moving, and he would be able to say to himself, "See, Jed, nothing to worry about. It's all over." "Hey, ugly doll," Jed said. "Can you hear me?" The doll didn't react. It continued its exercise routine, rolling its torso in wide circles. Jed knew that specific exercise was good for lower back pain. "Do you think you're going to stop this soon? Can you give old Jed his sanity back?" The doll didn't react. If there were anyone he trusted in Bakersfield, he would have had him come over immediately to test if he could see the doll's movements. In Bakersfield, though, he had only colleagues. There was Charlotte, the girl he saw sometimes at the stable. He considered her a friend, or just friends, as Charlotte termed it, but he couldn't simply call her up and invite her to the apartment. He had friends and family in Gilroy, but he wasn't willing to explain this over the phone. Having an on-the-scene witness was the only way to avoid being perceived as insane. The only thing to do was to watch and wait. He ordered a pizza. By the time the doorbell rang, the voodoo doll had been jumping and gyrating to inaudible music for nearly 20 minutes. Jed opened his apartment door as wide as he could, all but inviting the pizza boy inside in hopes that the skinny teenager might notice the dancing voodoo doll and say, "Hey, what the fuck is that?" Such a statement would confirm Jed's sanity. But the kid simply kept his bloodshot eyes on Jed and said, "That will be $17.76, sir." Jed took the pizza from the teenager, walked slowly across the room, and placed the box on top of the television. "Let me get my wallet," Jed said. He walked over to his dresser and very conspicuously picked up his leather Wrangler wallet. Jed lingered next to the voodoo doll that was now performing a carefully choreographed dance routine that Jed was certain had been lifted from MTV. The pizza boy didn't notice the doll. Jed watched the teenager run his hands through his hair and gaze at the inside of the apartment as if it were thick with smoke. Meanwhile, the voodoo doll began a highly suggestive series of pelvic thrusts. Only after Jed had offered a 20 did the kid's eyes appear to refocus. "Oh, thank you, sir," he said. The delivery boy turned slowly and left. Jed analyzed the interaction. Had the teenager been oblivious? High? Or did the dancing figure simply not exist? Jed had missed his opportunity for a second opinion. He ran to the door, opened it, and looked into the hallway. The pizza boy stood before the elevator, his skinny shoulders hunched forward. "Hey," Jed yelled, "can you come in here a minute? I've really got to show you something." The teenager turned toward Jed, his mouth open. Finally, he said, "Sorry, man, I don't go that way." The elevator bell chimed and the kid stepped in with a single long stride. Jed sat on the bed and ate his pizza. The doll had finished dancing and now seemed to be cooking, one arm holding an invisible frying pan, the other hovering above and circling in a stirring motion. If there had been smells or sounds to accompany the doll's actions, Jed thought he could deduce what it was cooking. Instead, he had to guess, and for some reason, decided that the left hand looked to be flipping a spatula so as to suggest an omelet. As he finished the last slice of pizza, Jed's laptop chimed to notify him he'd received an email. Ordinarily, Jed would have washed the pizza grease off his hands before touching his government-subsidized computer. Now, he simply wiped up quickly with a dry paper towel to read the reply from one of his voodoo experts, the Tulane professor. "Mr. Kendall, there is a legend of voodoo dolls so confused by muddled spells that they take on the traits of the very person they were designed to mimic. As the story goes, it is the person who influences the doll in such a case rather than the doll who influences a person's behavior. When this happens, the voodoo doll is called a hoodooing doll. Unlike a voodoo doll, a hoodooing doll has no potential for spells. It is simply the odd waste product of sloppy voodoo. I hope this helps. Dr. Shelton." While the professor's response was as close to a clear explanation as Jed had dared hope for, the prospect of buying into an ancient voodoo legend of giving weight to magical spells terrified Jed more than accepting what he'd seen as a grand illusion. The idea that some bum in New Orleans had somehow hexed his Bakersfield existence was unacceptable. What was perhaps most frightening was that this small figure was a window into someone else's life. Sweating now, Jed wiped his hands with a fresh paper towel. He typed a response in the hope of reaching the professor before he left his computer. Who makes this doll? Who will the doll mimic? When will it stop? Jed. Jed sent it off and waited for a response. The second-hand ticks of his Walmart clock seemed to echo in his apartment during his 3-minute wait. The professor replied, "It's just mythology, but I suppose the doll could be mimicking anybody at all, just as a voodoo doll can represent anyone. How did you get my email address?" If Jed could have dragged the professor through his computer and into his apartment, Dr. Shelton would have seen the voodoo doll eating its dinner, slicing into its tasty dish, and occasionally dabbing its widespread grin in a way to suggest that it used a cloth napkin far more sophisticated than Jed's length of paper towel. "Are you mocking a real person, doll?" The figurine ignored him again, and this time Jed wondered if it was because whoever had crafted the doll had forgotten to give it ears. The professor's note was no comfort. Instead, it brought into Jed's mind a whole realm of possibilities he'd never considered. He was now forced to speculate. Who was at home right now eating dinner and lifting his fork to his mouth in time with the hideous doll? How many more nights would Jed come home to spend time analyzing the doll's routine in search of clues as to its true identity? The clerk at the drugstore would have to be scrutinized for mannerisms similar to the doll's, as would the gas station attendant, the waitress at the midnight diner, and everyone else. The 9 hours he'd spent fretting over his doll's sudden animation would be nothing compared to the ongoing torture of knowing he was watching someone real through the figurine's actions. Jed watched the doll scrubbing dishes. He realized there would never be an easy way to unravel the mystery of his Who Doin' doll. Deducing any explanation for who had hexed the doll, why, and whom it represented would take years of research and treks through Louisiana, Haiti, and Africa. Or he could drive himself crazy, searching each continent for the object of his doll's mimicry. The remainder of his life would turn into a hopeless search across the globe. The figurine stopped its dishwashing and became inanimate again when Jed wrapped his fist around a delicate twig leg. Jed closed it inside an old shoebox and placed the box deep inside his bedroom closet. His apartment now looked like it did before. Safe, simple, regular. But were things back to normal? Jed couldn't help but wonder if the shoebox shuddered with life. He removed the problem, but hadn't solved it. Jed watched his closet door, half expecting to see it swing open with an eerie creak and the little clay head to peek out. After just a few minutes, Jed fished the box out and opened it. There was his doll on its hands and knees, one hand moving in a circular motion as if cleaning a spill. He could have thrown the doll into an alley dumpster and sent it away with the morning trash, but like the shoebox, that would not have satisfied him. These solutions provided no finality. Jed knew he'd forever imagine the doll miming out mopping while standing on top of the municipal landfill or slicing bread amidst acres of hefty bags. Jed needed to witness the doll stopped. He placed it back on his bureau. Jed woke the next morning to the buzz of his alarm clock, sat up on his futon bed, and looked toward his doll. It was already awake and moving, running its left hand through its wiry hair in long strokes. Jed realized he'd never really looked closely at the doll's actions, but had simply been fixated on the implausible fact that it had moved at all. Now, he could see the doll was brushing its long hair. The figurine then leaned forward and circled its double row of straight white teeth with the ends of its arm. Though Jed was unfamiliar with the female morning bathroom routine, and his doll did not have lips, he could see it was applying lipstick. It was clearly a woman. Jed suddenly felt a bit guilty and excited about catching a glimpse into the doll's most intimate behavior. He thought about looking away as the doll continued to examine her face in an invisible mirror, then remembered that her hollow black eyes had never seemed to recognize his existence. Still, leaning forward a bit, the doll fluffed her wispy hairs with her stumped hands and turned her head slightly, perhaps to inspect blemishes on her nose or cheek. Jed thought of the doll for the first time as a person with a human face. Every weekday morning, Jed woke at 6 a.m., ate dry toast, drank coffee and orange juice by 6:15, then into the shower, all in time for an 8 a.m. arrival at his government cube. However, on this day, he'd spent a good 15 minutes sitting in bed watching the doll get ready for her day. Jed then skipped breakfast and once he got into the shower, stayed too long. While the warm water washed over him, Jed began piecing together a complete personality from the doll's cumulative actions. She liked to dance, exercise, clean, cook, smoke an occasional cigarette, and lived alone. In the morning, she spent a good deal of time in front of the mirror, and her careful inspection of her face made Jed believe it was possible she was a bit self-conscious. Jed had heard it said that beauty lies within, but in the doll's case, he believed beauty lay in some young woman's apartment miles away from Bakersfield. Freshman year, Roy had dated Karen for nearly 6 months. She had spent a good deal of time in their room, but Jed rarely talked to her when she was there. Karen had always filled the space with the smell of her perfume and shampoos and often wore tight-fitting sweaters that looked soft to the touch. Each time Jed had seen her, her long blonde hair had looked as though just brushed to a golden sheen. Jed had rarely looked her in the eye because he'd been certain that if he had, both she and Roy would have instantaneously known that he wanted to touch her smooth hair and rest his cheek against her soft sweater. Jed had probably spent more time around Karen than he had with any other girl his own age. For that reason, while Jed worked in his government cube that day, he couldn't help but compare his hideous voodoo doll to Roy's ex-girlfriend. Jed imagined there were similarities between what he had seen his doll doing and the things Karen might have done in her everyday life. And while Jed did not condone smoking or understand what joy could be gleaned from a choreographed dance, he began to think his doll could be mimicking someone whom he might well like to know. Jed decided it might be tolerable, perhaps even enlightening, to have her around his apartment for a while, and since she was going to be with him all of the time, it was only fitting that he give her a name. Sitting in the safety of his cubicle, Jed turned a page of his legal pad and took out a ballpoint pen and made a list. Karen? Already taken. Kelly? Kristen, Christy, Jed moved toward a more systematic approach. Anne, Anna, Annabelle, Anita, Barbara, Betsy. Before too long, he had filled several pages. He lifted the pad off his desk and held it at eye level to read it over. "Is that the Cowboys' black book?" Jed swiveled to face the direction of the voice. Randy loomed, hands on his hips, coffee breath wafting towards Jed's nose. "Oh, hey, Randy, these are just, they're just names of your Saturday night honeys? Is that it, cowboy?" Randy smiled, and Jed could see the gum line between his wide-spaced teeth was discolored, slightly brown. "I may get a pet," Jed said. "I bet you will, cowboy. A sweet kitty or a wild beast? Rawr!" Randy made claws with his fingertips and gave a soundless chuckle. His chest and shoulders bobbed, and he curled his upper lip. Before Jed could figure out why his lie had failed, Randy saluted and left the cube. Jed looked at his pad and circled the name Olympia. It was the only one on the list whose beauty, Jed felt, could override the ugliness of the refuse-constructed doll. Olympia sounded important, symbolic of something, and Jed thought this unimaginable happenstance was probably representative of something greater for both him and Olympia. Something grandiose was happening, and Olympia seemed the name for it. Growing up, Jed's family had owned a golden retriever named Mac, and each day Jed rode home on the school bus, he'd pictured what it would be like to be reunited with his dog. While sitting on his final seat, Jed could imagine opening the front door and seeing Mac running toward him with his tongue out and his tail wagging. Now, driving his truck back from the Wild Horse and Burro division, Jed found himself imagining stepping through the front door of his apartment to see Olympia atop his bureau. She might be on the phone or completing household chores, but she would doubtlessly be there to greet him. Jed opened the door. Olympia sat on the dresser, peering into her lap. She moved an arm end from one knee to the other, then again, which made Jed think she was reading a book or a magazine. Jed placed his wallet next to her, knowing sometimes Olympia liked to sit on it. Her upright position atop the wallet looked much more comfortable than her current pose. Jed sat on the bed and watched her read. He tried to imagine her bristly hair as a long, straight, blonde mane. Though her mouth still appeared a skull-like row of teeth, Jed knew her lips had been carefully coated with a glossy sheen that morning. Jed looked at his watch and realized it was 6:30. Even inside his apartment, he could feel the late September desert sun give way to cool dusk. He'd been watching Olympia read for nearly a half hour. He got up to boil water for a pasta dinner, but stopped on the way to the stove and contemplated Olympia's positioning. Jed was uncertain of her relationship with the objects in his room. She seemed able to utilize his wallet as a lounge chair and the boombox as a coat hook, yet also maintained a relationship with elsewhere existing objects. She held invisible items, cooked on a stove Jed couldn't see, and peered into her own TV. She clearly had some concept of Jed's apartment space. She never fell off the dresser, yet didn't climb down to explore either. It occurred to Jed that Olympia might be more comfortable if he were to provide her with a few small pieces of furniture. Jed pulled an empty Cheerios box out of the trash, pulled his army knife from his pocket, and fetched some masking tape. He built a cardboard chair and placed it on the dresser. Jed pressed on the seat to test its durability. Next, using the same cardboard box, Jed made a table. He cut out rectangles from an old fleece blanket and lay them atop one another, making a bed. He sat again, admiring the habitat he'd created. Olympia still read on the dresser top. Jed thought about taking over a small dish of water to serve as a bathtub, but thought it might be inappropriate to encourage Olympia to bathe in front of him. He would no longer feel comfortable watching her remove her gemstone jacket and tattered pants. When Olympia walked over to her Cheerios chair an hour later and sat down, Jed felt a barrier between them had fallen. Their separate existences overlapped. A plate of half-eaten pasta in his lap, Jed asked, "Do you like it, Olympia?" He was instantaneously embarrassed by his irrational exuberance, the too wide grin on his face, then relaxed a bit when he remembered the doll didn't have any ears and that her eyes were cavernous black holes with no capacity for sight. "Do you like it? I made it myself," he said, "handcrafted from a single piece of lumber." She tossed her hair with her arm end, then reached out as if pointing to a remote control. She nestled her clay head into the chair's headrest. Jed stood, extended his pointed finger, and gently stroked Olympia's bumpy twig knee. She didn't turn rigid as she had before, but reclined in her chair. Jed wondered if the real Olympia, the human version, might also be feeling his light touch. He continued to run his fingertip along her leg, fearing at any moment the spell would be broken and the doll would return to its stiff state. "Olympia, do you think you might speak to me someday?" "You do have a mouth," Jed said. The doll's vacant eyes stared off toward the unseen television screen. Olympia slept on her fleece-lined bed when Jed woke the next morning. She lay on her side, knees pulled up to her stomach, her chest moving in and out with the slow breathing of deep sleep. "Good morning, my pet," Jed said. It was his first attempt at creating a term of endearment for his female companion, but even to his own ear it fell flat. It sounded overly Victorian, so Jed thought he would try a nickname more in line with his ranch hand roots, like Little Doggy or Fine Filly. Jed placed his hand close to Olympia's face to see if he could feel her breath. But although her body moved during her inhales and exhales, she wasn't taking in or expelling air. Jed told himself that in a few days, that could change, just as her relationship to his furnishings and his touch had. Though Jed had created a comfortable environment for Olympia, it occurred to him that it was silly to confine her to his dresser top. There was no reason why she shouldn't accompany him to work. Of course, He wouldn't leave her on his desktop for Randy and others to see. He could easily create a space for her inside one of his file cabinet drawers. The tall drawer walls would create an atmosphere similar to a New York City loft, complete with exposed beams. Jed packed Olympia and her furnishings into a shoebox. He left the file drawer under his desk open just a crack in case Olympia preferred a bit of light. The opening also allowed Jed to see Olympia sitting on her Cheerios box throne, arms raised in front of her as if she were also working at a little desk. Like Jed, Olympia apparently held an office job. Occasionally, she moved from her seat and walked around. Jed guessed she was probably strolling to the printer or perhaps over to the water cooler. Watching Olympia during the day cut into Jed's productivity, but he could think of no clear policy against what he was doing. The handbook had said no pets at work, no children, but Olympia didn't fall into either category. At the end of his day, and by the look of her posture near the end of Olympia's, Jed packed the doll into his shoebox and headed home. He put the box on the passenger seat. Long day at the office, eh, little filly? It sounded right. They headed home along the wide, hot streets of downtown Bakersfield. Packing Olympia up before leaving for work in the morning became part of Jed's routine. He built in 5 extra minutes for the task and now woke at 5:55 a.m. On the weekend, too, he put Olympia on the front seat of the pickup when driving to the grocery store or to the stable. He got to know her routines, her body language, her hobbies and habits. She was a lot like him, a homebody for the most part, a hard worker, a reader, and a movie buff, though on the weekends she often drank too much, which impaired her walking. She smoked the occasional cigarette and gabbed on the phone a lot. Jed knew she was beautiful. She took great pains in her appearance, both before bed and in the morning. She ate reasonable portions, worked out quite a bit, and liked to dance. She chose her clothes carefully, sometimes dressing more than once to get her outfit right, although to Jed she always appeared to put on the same gemstone jacket and torn pants. And because he knew she was beautiful, Jed was not surprised when her habits started to change, when it became clear she'd found a boyfriend. Jed first started to recognize certain meals as dinner dates based on Olympia's posture, careful use of utensils, and head movements that implied mid-meal conversation. Walks to her doorstep, which to Jed looked like laps around his dresser top, ended at first with hugs, then more recently kissing. Jed noticed she talked differently on the phone, standing up during some calls rather than slumped in her usual seated position. When this happened, Jed presumed Olympia had her boyfriend on the line. Jed knew Olympia was lonely, like him. He was glad she'd found a companion, and even thought briefly that perhaps this meant he would also find love. He said as much to Olympia one night while falling asleep. "Maybe I'll find someone too, Olympia. Then we'll both have someone else, someone we can actually talk to." The lights off, Jed could still make out Olympia's small body and silhouette, the street lights coming through the window. She lay curled up and asleep, breathing heavily. A few days later, Jed woke during the middle of the night to the sound of Olympia flopping down on the dresser. He turned on his light and saw that her chair had been overturned. Olympia lay flat on her back. At first, Jed thought an invisible assailant was attacking her. He popped out of bed, wanting to grab hold of her and return her to her frozen state. Then, Jed noticed her arms were outstretched and bent just slightly, her neck stretched up and her head was tilted to one side. Olympia was in an embrace. Her legs opened up and then wrapped around an invisible body. She looked clumsy. Jed hoped she was at least drunk, but it was Wednesday and Olympia never drank during the week. A moment later, Olympia sat upright, grabbed her waistband, and shimmied out of her ratty orange pants. She removed her jacket. With her string-bound twig-wire limbs exposed, Olympia lay flat on her back. Her hips gyrated slowly and her head tilted back. Her clay head scraped against the dresser top in time with her body's rhythmic motions. Though disgusted, Jed could not look away. Olympia's movements became more emphatic until it was over and she lay still. Not moving from her spot on the bare dresser, she curled up and slept. Jed stayed awake longer, explaining away her actions. He felt like he'd witnessed his childhood sweetheart defiled. It didn't seem like Olympia to act so rashly, but she was lonely and impressionable. Given a chance, Jed might have done the same thing on a Wednesday night. The first act had been jarring, yet forgivable. After the second, third, and fourth occurrences, it grew tiresome. Afterward, Olympia's lifestyle became repugnant to Jed. He often closed her inside her shoebox to keep from witnessing her numerous sex acts. Her positioning became more creative, and it seemed to Jed that her jacket and pants spent as much time at the bottom of the shoebox or on top of his dresser as they did on her thin body. It wasn't just before and after the workday either. Once during his lunch hour, Jed peered into his file drawer and saw Olympia naked, bent over her Cheerios chair in an almost impossible position. Not only did Jed find it sickening, but he also wondered if perhaps this pose might affect the integrity of her twig construction. A leg might simply splinter and snap off. It looked unhealthy, yet she didn't ease up. Perhaps Olympia was not like Jed at all, but more like Roy. Jed had unwillingly heard tales of Roy's sexual exploits and had always wondered about the type of young woman to be involved in such grotesque tales. Perhaps it had been a woman like Olympia, a sex fiend MTV watching smoker who bar hopped on weekends until she couldn't walk straight. Olympia didn't even appear anymore to take the time in her appearance. Workdays sometimes ended before 5 o'clock. Her dancing had become a bit too seductive, almost embarrassing and lewd. The doll went through her exercise routine far less frequently. Coupled with more meals out, Jed was sure she was gaining weight. Jed was as unproductive without Olympia under his desk as he had been with her there. At every moment, he couldn't help but think about what she was doing. He wondered whether she was meeting her boyfriend for a noontime quickie or chatting with him secretly over her workplace phone while twirling the cord around her free hand. Jed could foresee no easy solution to his relationship with Olympia. He couldn't very well get rid of her simply for her crude behavior. She wasn't aware he could see into her bedroom. Because Jed worked 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, he had never considered that a voodoo priestess might enjoy a more nebulous work week. To Jed, an expert was someone who checked her email daily, if not hourly. In Jed's mind, experts gave answers quickly and got their facts straight. He had all but forgotten about the experts other than Dr. Shelton, whom he'd emailed weeks earlier, until he recognized an address, Widow Paris at stlouis1.net, as belonging to a voodoo priestess. She had her own website. Jed had counted this against her during his initial research. He thought it unlikely that she was authentic, but at the time had been desperate for any information. The message read, "Monsieur Jed, only a doll with a serpent spirit inside can move that way. A doll like that is too strong. A dangerous type of witching has been done. You got to stop that doll. Cover it with mud from the Mississippi. That'll keep the spirit from seeing the human world. And he'll leave the doll. I can send you mud. $50 a jar, cash." It sounded like the money-making scheme of a web-based voodoo guru, but there was no doubt Olympia's allure was powerful, and Jed considered it possible he'd been bewitched in some way. He certainly wasn't himself. The end of daylight savings had stolen an hour from the night, and Jed drove home around 5:15 p.m. under a black sky. The desert chill set in an hour earlier, too, and Jed wore his sheepskin jacket over his dress shirt. He stopped at an ATM and withdrew $50. He hadn't decided the priestess was right, but hers was a proposition worth considering. Jed stood outside his apartment, his key still in the door's lock, and already could hear the rhythmic bumping of Olympia against his dresser top. Jed walked in and saw her naked, quivering legs in the air, back arched so that only her shoulders and ass touched the dresser's surface. He grabbed a t-shirt from the dresser drawer and threw it over her. He could tell from the relief imprint of her body that she'd resorted to her lifeless state. Her legs had relaxed and lay flat. Jed picked her up inside the shirt like he would a dead rodent and placed her in the shoebox. But Olympia was insatiable that day, and Jed heard the same noises again just an hour later. It happened for a third time that night. The Olympia Jed had constructed in his mind, the beautiful, lonely young woman in need of furniture and friendship, had vanished. Jed wondered now if, in fact, Olympia was with just one man, or whether her sexual appetite could only be quenched by several partners. Really, nothing about her appealed to Jed any longer. He felt as though he were stuck in a movie theater for weeks watching an abhorrent, unsympathetic character on screen. He reached into his pocket and fingered his Swiss Army knife. The blade was likely too short, but a kitchen knife could easily sever Olympia's clay head from her limber body. Her stick limbs could be chopped into unrecognizable mishmash. A grocery bag could serve as a graveyard. Dr. Shelton had assured him, a Hoodooing doll has no potential for spells. Destroying the doll would be harmless to the human Olympia. She could go on scrumping day in and out and in and out. The more he thought about it, the more it seemed the only rational thing to do. Forget the Mississippi mud. Forget tracking the doll's objects of mimicry. Jed wanted a return to normalcy, a clean break. Jaw clenched, Jed did his best to suggest a nonchalant air as he walked into the kitchen nook. He reached into a drawer and withdrew his sharpest carving knife. He feared the doll might suddenly develop the cognitive capacity necessary to foresee her demise. Jed walked back to his dresser with a knife behind his back like a horror movie stalker. He reached out and grabbed the doll. Although asleep, she grew rigid, and Jed used his left hand to press Olympia's ugly face into the dresser's wooden surface. With his right hand, he held the knife an inch above her twig neck and chopped her head from her folk art body with a single violent strike. Olympia's lumpy skull scooted loudly across the bureau. Next, Jed went to work on the limbs, slicing right through her bright orange pants. He cut across her thin waistline, through her arms, and just in case the doll possessed some sort of voodoo spirit, cut into the spot where her heart would be, comforted to find only more twigs and wire. Soon there was nothing left resembling a human form, only bits of twig and cloth. Olympia was gone. Jed breathed heavily and stared at the mess on top of his gashed dresser. The apartment was still and lifeless, and Jed felt a calm creeping back into him. All that was left was easily cleaned up with a broom and a dustpan. As Jed swept up the pieces and secured them in a plastic grocery bag, he thought of the wonderful predictability of arriving at work tomorrow with no dancing doll left behind in his apartment. Roy called him late in the afternoon that Saturday. "Yo, Jed, I'm in San Fran." "Yeah, you at a conference?" Jed hadn't spoken to anyone outside of work since chopping up Olympia and was thankful for the call. "Yep. How you doing, Jed? How's work? How are the wild ponies?" "Okay, okay. Keeping me busy, you know." "How about the little fillies, hey?" Jed felt obliged to chuckle, but the question pained him. "The numbers are down a bit this year, Roy." "I hear you, man. I hear you. Listen, come and meet me. I'm downtown in the Grand Hyatt. The company set me up pretty nice." Jed looked toward his bureau. The spot where the doll had once lived was marred. The evidence of his violence made Jed want to leave the room, maybe even leave Bakersfield. It had all been so gruesome and ridiculous. "Yeah, Roy, I'll come up." "Yeah, we'll see the city a bit. Gotta help me get through this per diem." Jed got off the phone and packed an overnight bag. He did his best to dress for a night out in the city, which meant office attire, a blue dress shirt, black pants, and leather shoes. He looked in the mirror, ran his hand over his flat top, stiff spikes, and wondered if he should grow out his hair. In his sock drawer, Jed kept a bottle of Stetson, a gift from his dad that he had used sparingly since the age of 16. He dabbed a bit behind his ear. Reaching the door, he turned and looked back, a quick check to make sure everything was in order before he left for the day. On the dresser, almost hidden by his stereo, he noticed one of Olympia's purple buttons sparkling in the light of his Walmart lamp. He closed the door and got into his pickup and headed north. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's story. If you did, please leave a rating and a review. Also, please tell a friend directly. Personal recommendations help a lot. My main goal with this podcast is to grow an audience for future work, and it'd be great to connect with more odd people who like strange art. I'd love to connect on social media. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Theodore Carter 2, or on Facebook with the handle at Chilean sea blob. This story and other stories in this podcast are part of my book, The Life Story of a Chilean Sea Blob and Other Matters of Importance. The book is available wherever books are sold online, and you can find links to all of my books on my website, theodorecarter.com. You can also find other things there, like videos of me making a giant cement eyeball or turning traffic boxes into robots. Music from this podcast comes from TMI Management, TMIMGMT.com. Thanks again for being here, and I hope you come again.